I'd like to welcome everybody to this career talk for Leonie Watson. We will have questions primarily at the end, but if you've got things that you'd like to raise as we're going through, please feel free to send them in, and Julian will try to fit them in at an appropriate point, or otherwise we'll come to them, as I say, at the end. So, welcome to Leonie. Leonie is a co-founder and director of Texological and chair of the W3C board of directors, and terms herself as an accessibility specialist with a particular interest in web and web-related technologies, such as the agentic web, AR, stroke VR, and conversational interfaces. And we'll be certainly touching on some of those things as we go through. But maybe first of all, Leonie, could you say a little bit about yourself and your hobbies and so on?
Sure. Hello, everyone. Particularly those whose names and voices I recognize from over the years. So, as Tony said, I'm Leonie Watson. Been a member of BCAB for I think 23 years now. When I look back today, I lost my sight in the year 2000. Before that, I'd been working on the web for a few years. The web back then, of course, was very, very new. Before that, I actually did performing arts at university, but having lost my sight, got into accessibility and career kind of carried on from there. And yeah, I've been generally keeping myself mostly out of mischief ever since. Hobbies is an interesting one, though. What I do for a living is kind of my hobby. I genuinely love what I do for a living, and so it doesn't feel like work. So my weekends and evenings are as likely to find me tinkering around with technology and accessibility and related topics as you are to find me doing that during the day. I don't know if that makes me lucky or to be sympathized with, but yes, I do like cooking though and reading an awful lot. So that's probably the closest things I get to hobbies, I think.
So was it essentially web accessibility that got you into technology as a career?
As a career, yes, I'd always been interested in technology. My dad had bought an Apple IIe back in the early 80s, with the idea it would help him run his business. I don't think he ever figured out how to actually use it as a business tool, but I do remember this was back when Apple used to publish a magazine that had code in it that you could sit there and faithfully copy out, and you'd spend hours doing that and then hit enter to run the whole thing, and you'd get a syntax error on line one error, and that'd be it. So ever since then I did have an interest, but yes, it was losing my sight and responding to an email from a then fledgling company to say they'd built their first website but they didn't have budget for accessibility testing, but they really wanted to know if any screen reader users, you know, could give them feedback, and I did, and that's where I discovered this whole thing about accessibility. And it really took off from there.
Can I ask a bit about job seeking? I don't know how much sort of conventional job seeking you've had to do, really, but I'm interested in issues like did you mention your disability on your CV and your approach at interviews and so on?
So I'm afraid this is one area where I am absolutely no help whatsoever. Right from that moment when I responded to that email I just mentioned, that then led to me getting my first job in accessibility. I stayed in that company, Nemensa, for gosh, 10, 12 years. And
Right.
by the time I'd left there, I gained a reasonable sort of reputation, I suppose, within the industry. That then led to the next job I got and the one after. But they all happened sort of not quite by invitation, but through connections and relationships I'd already forged. So I've fortunately, I think, never had to address the conversation of, you know, letting someone know that I'm blind and having to deal with that situation within an interview process,
Right.
which I'm profoundly glad for. But yes, I'm afraid it does mean I can't offer anything useful to help anyone else in that situation.
You mentioned when we were preparing that you did a second degree at the Open University in computer science.
I did.
Did you find much of that helpful when you got into a web development or web accessibility related career?
It did help me in ways that were slightly perhaps unexpected, though. So as I said, I'd been working on the web for a few years already in the late 90s by the time I lost my sight. And it was after I lost my sight when I was still at home. I'd left my previous job. Nobody had told me that I could get help learning how to use a white cane yet. I hadn't discovered, the RNIB Talking Books Library, and I was at home going, quite frankly, spare. And a friend said, "Well, look, you've discovered these things called screen readers exist. Why don't you try doing an online course?" And I chose one called You, Your Computer, and the Internet. Of course, I knew all about the internet. I'd been working on it for a few years, but what it did let me do was give me a structured way to figure out how to use a computer again, but this time with a keyboard and a screen reader instead of a mouse and a monitor. And it was horrendously painful. I remember it took me at least a day to figure out how to get JAWS to let me log into the damn course online, because I just didn't have a clue. I had no idea how to use these things. But bit by bit, I figured it out, and then discovered I was actually really enjoying myself. So one course became another, and eventually, yeah, it resulted in a computer science degree.
I'm not sure how the timing of these things will have worked out for you, but I remember those days of the sort of mid-90s where we got early Windows-based screen readers, which were tough to use in some respects. How did you kind of get through that period?
So JAWS 3.7 was the first version I used. So that would have been, I guess, 2001, maybe 2002.
Okay.
As to how I got through it, what my mother used to call a large amount of bloody mindedness, I think, and I'm sure that'll be familiar to many people here. Finding ways to
But
get around it.
persevering,
I was
yeah.
fortunate that I had good technical experience already, and my then boyfriend, now husband, is another, technical professional person. He's a software engineer. But actually, one of the things that made the biggest difference was joining this community, BCAB, as it was back then. After I'd lost my sight, the local council got in touch and said, "Hey, why don't you come to these, evenings for young people who are blind and partially sighted?" And I was just thinking, that's like throwing me into a group of any other people's. I don't know that I'm going to have anything in common with them. I might, but I might not. And it didn't really appeal. And then I don't remember how I learned about BCAB, now TAVIP, of course. But I remember thinking, great, there's a bunch of people that I know I've got stuff in common with. We're all into technology. And it so happens we're all, blind, visually impaired as well. And yeah, it was actually connecting into this community. And suddenly, there were people like Andrew and, Jeff and, David Bowden, Mike Townsend, others, so many people, that you could suddenly go, "Hey, I've got this problem. Anybody solved it before?" And you can
Yeah.
almost bet your bottom dollar somebody's been there, done that, got the t-shirt and figured out the accessible key commands to get you there. So yeah, that for me really was one of the most amazing things.
Yeah, we were just beforehand now we're talking about the value of the TAVIP discussion list and the sort of wealth of knowledge on that, and I think we're all very appreciative of that sort of vast bank of knowledge that's there to be tapped. It's incredibly useful. Could I ask then about the access technology that you use these days, the balance of Braille and speech and so on?
Full confession, I don't use Braille at all, and I know there will be shrieks of horror in certain corners. Quite simply, I was in my mid-20s when I lost my sight, and for anyone who's lost their sight as an adult, I hope you might appreciate, for me at least, by the time I'd figured out how to use my computer again and cross the road and do the grocery shopping, and then somebody came along and said, "Hey, Do you want to learn how to read again too? No. No, I don't. My entire life has just been upended, and I've more or less got it squared away. I did try, and I just didn't have the patience. And of course, technology, provides so many alternative solutions, And I, as an adult, I think that's one thing. As a young person, a school age person, I think, the value of learning Braille is, critically important. I think it's probably still arguably important as an adult, but I never quite got my backside into gear to do it. Apart from that, I still use JAWS as my primary screen reader. I didn't feel the urge to flip over to using a Mac when they suddenly became more accessible. And I know JAWS, it's familiar, it's comfortable. I know where I'm at with it. And again, the lazy part of me never wanted to go through the learning curve of figuring out a new screen reader any more than I wanted to figure out a new operating system. Other than that, a fairly standard Windows laptop. In terms of assistive technologies, all the usual apps and bits and pieces that many of us use. iPhone, I've got, Be My Eyes, Seeing AI, a whole bunch of those kind of things. And more recently, of course, AI-enabled technologies. I've got a pair of Meta Ray-Bans, which I find invaluable. And yeah, I think that pretty much sums up most of the technologies I use day to day.
You mentioned in our pre-meet a little bit about Scribe Me. Can you tell me about what experiences you've had with that?
So again, that's something I've got Tavit to be thankful for. It was the mailing list that put me, made me aware of that. So it's an app that essentially does real-time audio description, and you can use it through your phone, or if you've got a pair of the Meta glasses connected, and I suspect probably any model of those Meta glasses. So as you're walking around, you can get quite slow but reasonably useful real-time descriptions of what's around you. So where with the Meta glasses at the moment, you pretty much have to ask it what it can see, and it takes a photo and it'll describe it for you. This, you don't have to do that. So you can, just walk through an environment, and as long as you don't move your head too quickly, because it does lag a little bit, it can tell you all sorts of things. So I tried it out recently. I was in an airport at Heathrow, and they did the usual thing, plonk me in a wheelchair to scoot me through the airport. So all right, glasses on, scribe me up on. And for the first time in goodness knows how long, I was just getting, oh yeah, you're passing a bookshop on the right, and you're in a very wide, white corridor with purple and orange branding all over, and there's a big billboard poster on there. And so it went
Amazing.
on. Yeah, it was truly. I was just, yeah. Yeah, absolutely amazing.
Going back to your preference for speech or your choice to go with speech, and I fully understand the reasons you did that. You've obviously done a fair amount of kind of web debugging, accessibility issues finding, and presumably a fair amount of coding as well. You managed to do all that with speech, no problem.
I would say no problem, but yes, I do manage it. I mean, I don't get to code nearly as much as I used to these days. And that is definitely one of the areas where I think, Braille would undoubtedly make life an awful lot easier, or certainly more efficient, anyway. But yeah, I muddle through and I manage okay. To be clear, though, I've never been a professional software, coder, if you see what I mean. So, I dare say if my job was to be a software engineer, that probably would have been enough to prompt me to learn Braille and yeah, all the benefits that would have brought. But at the level I tend to code, which is either to, fiddle around with my own website or just build sort of prototypes or proofs of concept or, pick apart other people's code, it's yeah, perhaps not quite so essential.
That's interesting. I mean, in a similar way, I had a lot of my career teaching database systems, for which I mostly taught SQL, and I got by with speech alone with that. I think if it had been other languages, particularly possibly that used a lot of spatial semantics to convey what was going on, then that would have been trickier. Not
Yes, I did
necessarily, yeah.
try teaching myself Python, which does exactly that, and gave
Yeah.
up before either me or it came to came to blows.
I mean, I think, there are things you can do
Yeah.
to tell you about indentation and stuff, but I think it probably is easier in Braille and certainly quicker to get an
Absolutely.
overview of the sort of layout of a program.
Right, because you can feel the shape of it, which is going to be,
Yeah,
much, much
exactly.
quicker than listening to, yes, 16 tabs or 14 spaces or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So what have you enjoyed about the different roles that you've had? You obviously, you say work is like your hobby, effectively. So clearly, you've got a lot out of it one way or another.
I think at its heart, I like puzzles. And that's really what accessibility is all about. It's this idea of how do I take this thing that doesn't work for somebody or lots of somebodies, pull it apart and put it back together in a way that works better for them and ideally better for everybody. Sadly, I remember thinking back at the start of my career in the early 2000s that, if the average kind of, executive C-level type person in an organization is, 40 plus, it won't be long before they're all losing their sight, losing their hearing, da 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 da, and then they'll get accessibility and then organizations will figure it out. And yeah, nearly 25, 30 years later. Apparently now I'm in that generation where apparently everything's starting to fall apart in my contemporaries, and we don't seem to be too much further on when it comes to accessibility in many respects, unfortunately. And so that challenge has never really gone away. It's changed over the years. When I first started, I spent a lot of my time explaining that accessibility was a thing. And then we sort of moved on to explaining to people, okay, well, we know it's a thing, but what do we do about it? Now we seem to be, I will say, actually in a better space than we were. As in, I think there's a lot more awareness about it, a lot more teams, a lot more designers, builders are aware of it. The problems now are much more around how do we do this thing? How do we deal with all the legacy stuff that my organization's got in place? And how do we deal with all the tools and things that really aren't set up to enable us to do the accessibility we want to do? So it has changed. And of course,
It's
each change
good
brings
to hear.
challenges.
Yeah, it sounds like there has been overall progress from your perspective, and you're in a good position to talk about it. So, what would you say have been some of the toughest challenges that you've had to face on accessibility, web accessibility?
Oh, that's an interesting one. I think one thing I do remember is the realization that elements of accessibility that I had previously always assumed were quite simple are really not always. The company I was working for, this was probably back in the, I don't know, 2010 sort of ish time. And we were working with one of the Procter and Gamble brands, Mountain Dew. And the company I was working for had done an audit, accessibility audit of their website, and we found that most of the images on the Mountain Dew website didn't have any text descriptions. And so we filed this as an issue, thinking, right, all you've got to do, write some good text descriptions, stick them in your code, job done. And it took them, I think it was something like 3 years and several millions of dollars to get that one issue fixed, because they went to their content provider agency, who said, well, no, you didn't commission us to write content for images. We don't do images. So they went back to the graphic design company, who said, oh, no, we don't do words. You commissioned us to provide the pictures. And this went on, and eventually they had to get lawyers in. They had to renegotiate, multi-million dollar contracts before anybody would put finger to a keyboard, write a text description. And it's something that, any one of us could probably have done in 20 minutes. I would have thought, this was not rocket surgery by any definition. But yet, so that I think is one, one thing I remember, that realization that, yeah, never assume that this stuff is as simple as it ought to be. I think other challenges have been very different. So I was part of the original team that worked on the beta version of what's now the Gov.UK platform. And that came out of an interesting idea. Martha Lane Fox at the time, just after the economy had tanked after the global crash in 2008, she'd commissioned some research, and they'd identified the fact that if central government could get its act together and create a good usable online experience and encourage more people to get more stuff done there, the economy could save, I think it was about 600 quid per adult per year. So they set about this idea of what became Gov.UK. And that was brilliant because at first there was, I think, 25 of us in that team. And one of the first things we did was sit down and write a set of design principles. And one of them was that accessibility would be right there, front and center. And that was back in, what, 2011, I think, by the time that happened. And yeah, Gov.UK has grown enormous since then, and sure, some of the old problems have resurfaced in there, but by and large, I think they've really stuck to, those original design principles, and by and large, I think it's still a, a reasonably accessible experience. So that was nice to sort of avoid a later challenge, if you like.
Yes, moving into retirement, I've had to deal with that website much more than I ever have before. And I have to say, generally speaking, experiences have been fairly positive. So,
Good to
could you
hear.
tell us a bit about your current roles? For example, being a director at Tetralogical, what do Tetralogical do, and what's your part in that?
Tetralogical is an accessibility agency. So, four of us founded it in 2019. And we do accessibility training, audits, checking websites against guidelines, and sort of freeform consultancy, helping organizations get their accessibility mojo going, is the short description of it. And the four of us had known each other for many years, and we'd all worked together in previous accessibility companies over the years. And like many people who start their own companies, figured we could make as good a job of it as the others had before us, if not a better job, perhaps. So that's what prompted us to do it. And 7, almost 8 years later, we're still at it. There's 20 people in the company now.
Right.
So far, at least, so good, I figure. And I still get to do some of the accessibility work, which is it's important to all four of us who own the company. But of course, a lot of the rest of the time is spent with doing all the grown up company running stuff as well, which is equally interesting, if slightly different.
Yes. And being chair of the W3C board of directors sounds potentially like a huge role. What does that involve on a sort of day-to-day basis?
So on a day-to-day basis, it's not too bad. The it's a typical board of an organization, so it meets in person quarterly, and then at the roughly 6 week intervals in the middle of those, there's a remote Zoom-based meeting. So there's lots of herding cats and putting agendas together and making sure people have produced the right reports and everybody's looked at the right materials so they can come and be productive in the meeting. But in terms of what it sort of represents, to me, it's incredibly important. I've been participating at W3C for many, many years, and it really, to me, embodies a lot of the spirit of what the web is all about. This idea that everything should be open, accessible, private, royalty-free, international, all of those things. That's important. So to be
Yes.
able to chair the board that provides the governance for that organization and all it's accomplished, producing the web content accessibility guidelines, HTML, CSS, SVG, so many of the standards that the web is built on. That's the thing that makes me happy to be able to do.
Yeah, that's amazing. Could you say a bit more about Web Model Context Protocol?
Yes, I can. So it's It's a specification that's in incubation at W3C. So that means it hasn't been formally adopted as a work item yet. And what it's trying to do is make the idea of MCP or the concept of MCP, which has existed in agentics for a couple of years now, available in the web. What that means in practice is that at the moment, when an AI agent uses a website, goes to a website, so say you've got an agent, the example everybody gives is one to help you book a holiday. The agent actually will do a lot of the things that most of us will do, and they depend on a lot of the same things that we do as screen reader users. So they use computer vision, take screenshots of the pages in question to look for things that look like, call to action buttons, add to basket, go to checkout, for example. They use the browser's accessibility tree, which is the bit of the browser's accessibility model that our screen readers use to find out when, what a thing is, whether it's a button, a heading, a table, all of those kind of things. And this means that agents effectively come across the same problems that we do. All fine when it works, but if the information isn't there, both screen reader users and agents have a harder time of it. So the idea between behind Web MCP is that when you build your website, you'll be able to declare to AI agents these tools, these capabilities, these services, these bits of functionality are available on this website. So it takes the guesswork out of what the agent needs to do. And sort of running through this, of course, is the possibility that it might in time have uses for assistive technology users as well, but that's a little more uncertain at the moment.
Potentially very useful for us in the long run. So coming on to AI, I'd love to know what you see as the main advantages and, of course, the drawbacks of AI for blind people.
Sure, that's an interesting one to answer. So the advantages are access to so much information that I haven't had access to since I lost my sight. I know this will resonate with many of you, I'm sure, but the ability to get detailed descriptions of images and then be able to ask questions when the information I got the first time didn't quite answer the thing I needed answering. And being able to do that without having to ask anybody for help, just an extraordinary feeling. I've been back through photos that have been taken, literally over the past 25 years, sitting on a hard drive, and sure, I'd been through them with friends and family before, but I hadn't ever really been able to dig into the, oh, look, Auntie so-and-so was wearing a pink jumper and a red Christmas hat that day. That the level of detail is suddenly right there. And then of course, translating that out into the real world, the Scribe Me audio description, the ability just to find out what's around me in just in stupidly simple ways. Just I was sitting somewhere waiting for someone the other day and asked my glasses to tell me what I was looking at. Turned out I was looking at an advertising billboard. And it was just like, wow. Hadn't thought about one of those in donkey's years because they just don't register, of course, when you can't see. So yeah, having access to all that, and then of course, the navigational ability that it gives you, so much potential, and so many more things that are on the way. The guidance navigation systems, for example, are hugely interesting. All of that, I think, is extraordinary. I mentioned to you, Tony, when we were chatting earlier. Last month, I sat down and completely redesigned and rebuilt my own personal website without any help except for Claude,
That's
for the first
amazing.
time since I lost my sight. And building websites was what got me into my career on the web in the first place. That's what I was doing in the late 90s. So for me, it was this massive return to my what I wanted to be doing on the web all along, kind of a thing. And yeah, having that freedom to be able to do that. With I say no help. I did get my husband to just check everything visually looked okay because you can only trust AI so far before
Sure.
you publish something online. But
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
it was amazing. But the drawbacks, I think there's two sort of major drawbacks that I struggle with, to be honest with you. One's just the general paradox of finding myself being so excited, so amazed by the opportunities of all this thing, but at the same time recognizing that, most of the models that we use were trained on data that they had no right to be trained on, that they're really not doing good things for people in, the global south, again, because of the training mechanisms, the data centers, the consumption of water,
Yes.
all of those things. We know they're not good, but I don't have any good answers. I really don't. I find myself right in the middle of that paradox, and I don't know what to do, basically, because I'm not going to apologize for using something that offers me so much opportunity. But
Yeah.
in the back of my head, there's a voice going, yeah. I think the other problem that we're discovering, perhaps more recently, and I don't know how any of you feel about this, but it's the backlash in the past week or so about wearing AI glasses, particularly the Meta glasses. And I understand that there is a privacy risk there. I don't happen to think it's necessarily any worse than the privacy risk of someone capturing me in a selfie with their phone or being recorded on CCTV, footage without my permission. But the
Yeah.
language being used around this conversation, calling them pervert glasses and things is, it's really distressing. And I'm not a person that gets easily upset. I get irritated and get grumpy. I very rarely, get upset. And I do find this whole kind of terminology language around it really quite upsetting, because once again, we all seem to be, well, it's helpful to you, but good luck with that.
Yes, it's
So
so
yeah.
frustrating given the great uses for us
Right. Yeah.
that
Yeah, absolutely.
and I think we touched on once again in our pre-meet the fact that a lot of large language models are trained on data in which minorities such as the blind and visually impaired population are not well represented.
Yeah, absolutely. And we see this in so many different ways, and it's really not surprising. Every single misunderstanding, misconception that she says, waving a hand, the general public's got about different disabilities. So of these models, precisely because humanity's got these same misunderstandings, and it really got brought home to me when I was using ChatGPT a few months ago to plan a trip to China. And I told it I couldn't see, and I suddenly realized that every time it was suggesting something I might want to go and do, it would say something like, oh yes, you this will be really interesting to you, because there's lots of wildlife and birds in the area, for example, so you'll be able to hear lots of interesting kind of sort of sound textures and things. But then it would follow it up with something like, and you don't have to walk very far to get there. It's just like, wait a minute.
Walking's no problem,
Well, yeah,
yeah.
this is it. And it's just like, don't get me wrong, I'm completely lazy. I would rather not walk very far, but that's got nothing to do with the fact that I can't see what I'm up to.
Right,
It's
yeah.
entirely down to the fact that I'm a couch potato. But yeah, I suddenly realized that it somewhere along the line had got this idea that if you couldn't see, you didn't, wouldn't, couldn't walk. And the more I looked into it then, having kind of become aware of it, the more I realized, yeah, it has these things. But in the same way that if you ask any room of people, sighted people, can every blind person read Braille? Or can most people, who are blind read Braille? They will probably say yes, because that's sort of the received wisdom out there. Blind people probably wear dark glasses, have a white cane or a guide dog or both, and read Braille. And of course, we know the numbers are not necessarily quite that absolute, but received wisdom is out there. So that's what people think. So that's what these models think.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is a problem.
So, something that bears out exactly just what you were saying. I was reviewing a grant proposal yesterday, and they were talking about assistive technology used by blind and visually impaired people, and they said that Braille displays with a single line display were the primary means by which BVI people use computers.
Right.
Yeah, it's just a big misconception. It'd be great if you could talk a little bit about your use of LinkedIn. Having dabbled with it a little bit myself, I'd be really interested to hear how you find it and what you feel you get out of it. Yeah.
It's possibly the most loathsome platform that I have the great misfortune to have to use.
Right.
I'm a professional, so it is the platform really where if you're going to make, professional connections and such, you have to be. So doing what I do, I have to use it. I genuinely loathe it though. The only thing that gives me some slight sense of compensation, I suppose, is that apparently everybody else feels that it's equally loathsome and horrible to use. It's not just an accessibility problem. But yeah, I ne just never quite seem to know where I'm at, where I need to go to do what it is I want to do. And then flat out, there are some things that I just cannot seem to be able to do at all. I was trying to post an article, not a general sort of status update, but an article, and I just couldn't do it. I mean, I could paste the text into the edit field, but I couldn't work out how to style it for love or money, and eventually had to get
Right.
someone to help me to do it.
Do
So yes, it's
you find some things are easier on the phone with it?
I do, yes. Yeah. So I tend to manage all my network requests on the phone because I find it much, much simpler to do it there, and also messaging, like private messaging conversations. I just cannot figure out how to do that on my laptop at all. But then I do tend to sort of find it easier to actually read post feeds and things, and comment on things using the app on my laptop. So
Right.
definitely, yeah, different things in different places.
Yeah, that's interesting. Do you find the app better than the website then?
Better for the
That
things I use it for. And not for the things I don't, if you see what I mean. It's also slightly skewed by the fact that I dislike typing on my phone.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
mean, I don't know about anybody else, but I am much slower at typing on my phone than I am on my keyboard. And for something, which is why I prefer to do sort of commenting on things on my laptop, where I can type a bit more
Sure.
fluidly.
For people who've just not had to engage with it, in spite of all of this, you obviously still use it a fair amount, I think. So could you just say how you benefit from using it?
So it is a good way to stay in touch with people I've met, over the years. I have a general policy that I won't accept or send a LinkedIn request to connect to anyone I haven't had at least some meaningful exchange with.
Yeah.
That might be a Zoom meeting and a cup of coffee and a chat. It might be that I've known you for several years, or we've worked together on a project. But for me, at least, that's my sort
Your criteria.
of my criteria. So for that, it's a great way to be able to stay in touch with those people I have engaged with over the years. It's also a good way, as a business owner, to be able to speak to some of the things we're doing, whether that's new members of our team who've just joined, or new services we've launched, or blog posts, and the same for me and the posts I publish on my own website, helping offer a status update on LinkedIn. So it's useful for that, just sort of information sharing,
Yeah.
network sharing, those kind of things, and finding out about things, because of course other people that I connect with and I follow are publishing useful and interesting things about topics I'm interested in. And so if you can grit your teeth and
Yeah.
use it, it can be a useful source of information. Probably more so now in a professional sense than any of the other social media platforms. Twitter
Right.
for a long time used to be the, a really great source of all that kind of information, but I haven't used it since it became X, or probably a bit before that. And yeah, I personally thinking it's deteriorated quite a lot from where it used to be, and
Okay.
others, Mastodon, Blue Sky, are probably nicer environments to be in, but they haven't sort of really kind of come up to par with the sort of professional network exchange that Twitter used to be in its day.
Yeah. Okay. We're coming towards the time we're going to open this up for questions, but I think we'd be really interested to know of any particular advice you might have for TAVIT members who are interested in developing a career in technology, particular, but also maybe more generally about getting into employment or things that they can do to help develop their profile and improve their chances of employment.
Absolutely. So I think, taking a deep breath and using LinkedIn, X, if that's, a platform you're already using, Blue Sky, Mastodon, Facebook Threads, any of those things, and, sharing what you know. And even if you're at the very, very start of your career, whatever it is you're interested in, you will already know things of interest to share with other people. So, I think that's a really good way to start. And it might just be a quick thought. It might be that you've written a blog post, recorded a short video. Doesn't matter what, but get out there and start connecting with other people, making yourself visible. I think that's a huge strength. That you can do, because then bit by bit you become known as, someone to
A
follow
person that
because
knows
you
about.
share information on that
Yeah.
topic, and once people associate you with your, your chosen specialty or area of interest, then you build up the connections, and that, as it happened to me, can lead to job opportunities and other invitations. So, I think that's a really good way to get started, if you're brave enough, or perhaps the word is silly enough, put yourself forward for giving talks. Meetups are a really great way to do this, local meetups on whatever your subject of interest might be. Lots of meetups will have a talk, especially, for first time conference speakers. Might be a sort of a short 10-minute lightning talk as opposed to a full length one, but that's another really great way to do it if that's your kind of, area of interest, again, because it connects you with a whole group of people who are there precisely because they share an interest in the topic you're going to talk about, and that you can, help build up visibility, and keep learning. That's the other thing. Anybody who wants to work in technology, I think, has absolutely got to keep learning. It's one of the things I love about technology is it doesn't stand still. Everything changes, but that does mean you need to put the effort into to trying to keep pace with it.
Yes.
Other than that, just remember what a great resource we've got here at Tavit. Like I said right back at the beginning, for me, this is an amazing place. If you've got a challenge or you're not sure how to do a thing, there are almost certainly people here who've had a go at it before and can give you some advice or good ideas on how to do something, how to overcome something, figure out a solution. And don't ever feel that you're out there trying to do what you're trying to do on your own. There are always other people out there who come to a place like Tavit to be able to help and share information and do all those things. So call on that community.
Thanks, Leonie. That's really great advice. Incredibly helpful, and kind of things that actionable things that anyone can do, really, no matter what field of interest they're in. Okay, so it would be great to hear of any questions that people have for Leonie. We've covered a fair range of topics, but maybe something that we've not covered equally.
Yeah,
Let's
we've
hear
got
from you.
Andrew, you come in, you've got your hand up.
Hi, Leonie. Thanks for the information. I was just trying to work out how many questions I can ask you in one go. I have your experience with web accessibility. I take it has been predominantly with like say customer facing, i.e. B2C like websites. Have you done much accessibility work with companies, for example, who are employing blind people, for B2B, portals, that sort of thing? And as more of these now, what I'm finding in my day-to-day job is a lot of these portals are actually getting rewritten using agentic AI. And actually, I'm not going to say what I think, but because it's but I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the websites that are being generated through like Claude and other AI tools, in terms of their accessibility, because that may or may not hinder the progression of people using them, for, if they're blind, employees trying to use these portals, for example.
Absolutely. So at Tetralogical, we do a lot of work in with B2B products, as well as B2C, and actually in both cases, we're starting to see products coming our way that have been somewhere between agent assisted, which is generally what I refer to as people who are using AI agents almost as sort of pair programming partners, right through to vibe coding, which is essentially giving it a prompt and telling it to go away and dream up an app or a product or something. And sadly, for the moment, the results are really, really not good. And it comes back to that thing I was saying before about, these models making the same mistakes that humans make because they've been trained on all the mistakes that humans have been making for the past years. And we're really seeing that in accessibility. You can almost directly map the average number of issues that we see on a human-coded website will bear a remarkable similarity to the typical issues we're now starting to see on an AI-coded website. I think there is hope in the sense that as people get used to using AI in their kind of coding practices and stuff, something that's going to have to happen, and we're starting to see it happen, is you've got to figure out how to put in place the right checks and balances to make sure that what your agents are producing isn't absolute garbage. We're not at that point yet, so we're in a bit of a wild west, I think, where it's all going to get a bit worse before it probably tidies itself up and sorts itself out. Also, the tools are getting smarter. The models are getting smarter, with extreme rapidity. So it's quite possible they will stop making quite so many silly mistakes.
That is
But yeah.
that is really interesting, because I was actually going to, and this might be, this could sort of slightly another question, but it might be, to do with the way that I use, my screen reader and just my experience. But I'm actually finding that some of the websites that I, the portals that I'm having to access are actually becoming easier to use with the new
Interesting. That's
versions,
encouraging.
and I just wonder whether some of that is because I'm trying to use the websites as a user. I don't know anything about accessibility at all. I pride myself that I'm a blind person who doesn't know anything about accessibility,
Good
and
for you.
I'm just using the screen reader. And probably, in the past, I've had things like some of these websites are very old that I'm using, like are probably like were like 15, 20 years old. So probably, were use things like the mouse, those menus that you had to mouse over to get to and things like that. And those things are starting to disappear. Now I'm just wondering whether that, I'm finding them easier to use because I'm just so used to, using websites, these modern websites with a screen reader, even if I have to bash my head against a brick wall to get there. Whereas before they were just not usable. And that might be what I'm seeing, but I am actually seeing a positive, I'm for me, so there's been two recent changes, the portal upgrades that we've had in both my consultancy where I work and the company that I'm contracted to, where I've actually been able to even submit my timesheets in one case where I couldn't even do that before. So yeah, it's really interesting, but I'm interested that you said that. That's why I kept it open, because I didn't know whether whether you found it, was producing the accessible stuff or not. But of course, you're looking
I
at it
mean,
at a lot deeper level than I am.
I think both experiences, can be true at the same time. The real kind of important thing in all of this, though, is not so much whether AI is being used in the development of things. It's what the humans that are using the AI are doing in and around it. I mentioned that I'd redesigned and rebuilt my website recently, but then I know what good accessibility looks like. So, and I know how to write JavaScript and HTML and all the rest of it. So I could go through and just look at the code and be reasonably sure that what it had produced was what it said it had produced. I think where the tetralogical, we're starting to see the problems is where people who really don't know what good looks like, good coding, good software development, good accessibility, none of it, are writing a prompt. And their chosen model is spitting out some fully fledged app or website at the end of it. That's where we're starting to see the problems kind of come, is where there's no human checks and balances in place, if that makes sense. So if you're getting a better experience, hopefully that means there's some humans putting those checks and balances in place, and it's coming out in the right direction, which is encouraging to know.
Cool. Thanks very much.
So we've got another hand up from Carl. Carl, I'll bring you in. And then Andrew, maybe you've got other questions, you can come back in. So Carl, do you want to fire away?
Yes, hi. Again, thanks a lot for a fantastic, really interesting speech today. I've kind of caught some of your stuff on the web and YouTube. I'm actually, for my students, kind of struggling within the A11Y sector in a large corporate. We're a very, very small embryonic accessibility team, and we're trying to dip our toe across UKI. And yeah, it's very daunting. I'm still about what my 6 years to total blindness, with jaws and stuff. I'm still fairly early doors to that side of it as well. And yeah, I've done a little bit of HTML just to get my basics on there. A little bit of CSS knowledge, not a lot, nothing on JS. And I'd just like to get you some tips, advice, like what tools are you using? How are you best? Because we're using, as you know, different suppliers, etc. But we're using the DQ offering, DevTools Pro. And I've really found that hard, especially with the IGTs, to navigate and get around. Obviously, the tool saying, yeah, you can complete like four or five of these IGTs without sight. But then when you start digging into the weeds, it's really, really difficult. So we've highlighted this, we've highlighted that. You need to check this. Is this, is this button fully accessible? Is it just like thought, some tips on that. And also, where do you see, because I love AI, all of what you guys have talked about AI is fantastic. Where do you see the future? Do you see much more longevity within the GUI? We'll be using it for longer, much longer. And also, will there be like RAG resources for developers? So basically, like you said before, obviously at the moment we're just trawling the whole web and we're not getting all that accessibility data that we need to make sure every product tool, mobile app is fully accessible. How could that be embedded? So what, whoever just jumps on and says, right, create me this, create me a website, that it's automatic going to go to this resource, this Holy Grail, WC3, WCAG 3.0, and get all of that. What are your thoughts? Sorry, there's a lot there.
No, that's fine. Right. So, tooling things, I think tools like X and others that let you check for accessibility, the first thing to remember is that they're only capable of confidently testing for about 30, 35% of possible accessibility issues. DQ in their marketing blurb choose to quantify the way or the number of issues that their tool can check in a different way that every other provider on the platform, the planet does.
You've got even level access as well. They're all doing similar things, yeah.
They're all doing similar things, but everybody else generally says agrees on the kind of 30, 35%, and it's based on the number of success criteria from the web content accessibility guidelines that automated tools can check. DQ, for some reason, uses some metric that's based on the actual number of issues that have been reported using Axe over some period of time. So if you look at their metric, they say they can identify something like 90% of all issues and things. But they're using a completely different metric to the rest of the profession, so it's just slightly misleading. And the problem is that the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, or WCAG for short, they're very subjective. They're quite simple at first, but then there's a whole bunch of stuff that you've got to go and check for yourself anyway. So, one of these tools will tell you
Usability,
that, right. Well, even with the more pure accessibility things, these tools can tell you there's an alt text for an image, but they can't tell you if the alt text is any use to a human at all. So you've got to go check that. And I think that's probably, from the sound of it, where you're sort of running into those kind of complications, really the best way to deal with it is just one at a time. Increase your knowledge every time you come across one of those things that it says, right, you need to go and check this or double check that or follow up on the other. Do it, and it's going to be painstaking at first, but you will build up your knowledge and keep building up your knowledge. And
That's the hard bit. It's the manual testing is gold, isn't it? I mean, that's the impression I'm
absolutely. It
getting. And that's where
still
I still
necessary.
feel so weak. Would you give any as a good resources to build those skills? Because I've been using the W3 schools and stuff in the past. But anywhere else other than obviously you've got Duke University and stuff. Mozilla, MDN, that's been really good. Some good resource there
Yes, there's some good
as
sources there
well.
and some good people I know who contribute the accessibility content. The other thing I was saying, it sounds somewhat self-promotional, is my company's blog,
Okay.
which is tetralogical.com/blog. And we've got a series on there. There's a tag you can look called Foundations, and that looks at a whole bunch of those kind of topics, how to do this. But they're all really, and none of them written by me, I should say. This is all my team, I have to give credit to. But really good articles on, how to design, build, test, all kinds of
How do you
stuff.
find the variations? Sorry, the variations even between the screen windows, they do vary, don't they? When you're testing with JAWS, and then if you switch over to NVDA or even Narrator, they sort of pick up on different things, even the accessibility tree. JAWS tries to get a bit funky sometimes and picks up on like nearby or close associated for names,
Oh yes, JAWS's heuristics
etc.
can be an interesting in challenge. I mean, the way I've always approached it and the way my team approaches it is to ask the question, can you get X done with Y technology? And the answer has to be yes, but not necessarily in exactly the same way. So voiceover will generally call things images. Whereas JAWS or NVDA might call them graphics. It doesn't matter. As long as the person using them understands what is meant, job's good. So I think taking it like that, and then just looking at the market. If you're testing something that's going to be used primarily on a laptop or a desktop, look at the market. I think still 90, 95% of the market is going to be using Windows with a screen reader. So, that's where you need to put most of your time. Don't forget people using VoiceOver on Mac OS, of course, but be realistic about,
Stick to JAWS and NVDA,
And then, if you're looking at a mobile,
compare
probably
it
flip it
with.
around the other way. More of us are going to be using VoiceOver on an iPhone,
Oh
as
God,
far
yeah,
as, we're aware.
iPhone
So yeah, be practical about it. But really the question you've got to ask is, can person with X technology get Y job done? And if the answer is yes, that's what you need to
way.
check for.
And what are your thoughts on AI? The Holy Grail. Where are we going?
Where are
We
we
already
going? I
talked
don't.
about screens. The screen's dead. Are they gone?
So I swore off predicting the future of technology in 1997 when I made two claims. One is that Google would never replace Alta Vista as a search engine, and the other is that CSS would never take off. It rapidly became clear that both of those prophecies were entirely wrong, and I haven't really dared predict the future since then. I think things will almost certainly change, but it'll very much depend on what it is you want to get done. So I wrote about this a year or so ago. I don't know if any of you have used the website InnoSearch.ai,
Oh,
but it's got an agent and you can have a conversation. I want to buy a black sweater. I'm a size such and such.
really
I
good. Yes, good
don't like
website.
sequins and stuff. And it'll go off and find it, and then you can. Yeah, I found 19 results, and the first one's from, Marks and Sparks, and it's 30 quid and blah, blah, blah. And I'm sitting there thinking, I'm sitting here with a cup of tea, having a conversation. This is so easy. Why on earth would anybody, not, irrespective of disability, want, need a website? I get, if you're sighted, sure, you'd want to look at product images, but, that changes the visual nature of a website, rather than assumes we're all still kind of pointing, clicking, tapping our way through the whole thing. So I would be very surprised if we don't start to see more of that kind of conversational interaction, start to emerge. But of course, that's not going to work in every circumstances. You don't want everybody in an office chatting away to their computer. Although, interestingly, there's a massive emergence I hear in offices now of people using whispered AI technologies. So they're all talking to their computers, they're just
Oh,
quiet
okay.
voice.
So just I was thinking of Whisper Flow. Yeah, I'm
Yeah,
sure.
exactly.
Sorry,
So
yes.
maybe, people who are younger than I am will actually find that, totally normal and will happen more. But I know people do code using voice, but I can't for the life of me imagine wanting to do it myself. Again, that might be generational age experience, I don't know. So yeah, I think things will change.
And
In much in the way as they did when tablets and the iPhone first came out. It changed some
better
things a
let
lot
others
and
have.
other things not at all.
Lots of apologies. Better let the others have the floor in a minute. But lastly, WCAG 3.0. Any little nuggets? Any nuggets? How far off is that now? It's been
I think we're
quite a while
aiming
as
at
well.
2028, 2029
Okay.
at the moment. So yeah, still a few years away. I mean the draft version of the working draft, as W3C calls them until they're officially published, is really starting to come together now, as in you can see a lot of the guidelines in there and a lot of what the expectations will be. The big piece that's missing at the moment is the conformance model. How do you know when you've conformed to the guidelines? And there's furious amounts of discussion continuing about that. But as a set of guidelines and new advice, it's really starting to take shape. I would caution against using any of it now. It's still too far out to be stable
It's
enough
really
to
quite
actually
different to
use.
2.2, isn't it? With like the bronze, silver, gold, it's quite
Well, that's what I
different.
mean. The conformance model isn't settled, so we don't even know if we're going to keep those bits, if you see what I mean. But yes, it is going to be different in a whole bunch of ways. One of the ways is it should be easier to read and understand, which would be
Are you
a
saying that
blessing.
2.2 is not easy
Just
to digest?
absolutely horrendous. And I say this, and I've been involved in the working group that's developed
It's
the damn things
really
for
too, really
15 years. It's
difficult. It is
horrific.
really hard.
And it
It's
doesn't
really
even meet its own criteria. So,
if I've listened to them all once, I've listened to them 100 times, I still struggle interpretation.
whereas if you look at the draft version of three, you should start to see that the initial guideline is actually a lot simpler, and then the more detailed information is much more audience-based, which is nice. So yeah, if you're an accessibility consultant, there's information for you. If you're a developer, designer,
Oh yeah, no, it's broken down. Nice.
or that's the intent. It's still taking shape, but yeah. So I'm
And
very
last,
optimistic about it.
literally lastly, EAA, obviously we haven't got it. Do you think we'll ever get anything from it brought over here?
The last signal from the government was no. That was, I believe, just towards the end of the Conservative administration. But having said that, the current government hasn't signaled anything any different. So probably not, I suspect. There's arguably a lot more going on that the country needs to prioritize. Having said that, I think there is a knock-on effect. A lot of the businesses we do work with at Tetralogical are just lumping the UK into the European Union because we're barely off the coast of mainland Europe, and it doesn't
No,
make sense for
constant.
them economically or logistically to separate us out into a different market. So I think it is having a knock-on effect, but no, I don't imagine we'll see it adopted international law anytime soon.
Excellent. Thanks very much. Appreciate your time.
It's all right.
Fantastic. Take care.
Thanks, Carl. And so, Raymond, you've got your hand up. Do you want to come in, Ray?
Thanks very much, Julian. And thank you, Leonie. Good to hear you again.
Me too.
Is it possible to design and maintain websites that are equally accessible if people are using a smartphone or some kind of a PC? And is that usually proven to be the case, or?
Oh, absolutely. It's demonstrably the case. You've got to put some effort into it. Absolutely. I mean, it's been possible. I would say there was a big change in CSS probably about 15 years ago that solved the whole problem of all these different devices with different screen sizes. it became known as responsive design. So the idea being is that the design of the website responds to the screen size in question. So yeah, it is absolutely possible. You've just got to pick the screens that you're going to design and build for.
My reason for asking, unlike you and Tony, I've over recent years, and I've heard had other vision impaired people, particularly totally blind people, admit the same thing. I've increasingly seem to be finding that websites I used to able to get around very easily and with confidence and quickly, it's quite often no longer the case. And I've often thought and said to people, well, maybe it's because people are viewing websites more from their smartphones, that they're being designed more for that type of user rather than the PC user.
Yeah, I can see why you would think in that direction. My hunch is that it's due to changes that have happened in the development industry over the past couple of decades. As you probably know, most accessibility really comes out of the HTML that the website's built from. You know, that's how we know when a heading's a heading, a button's a button, text description, and so forth. And so in the kind of early years of the web, you know, everybody used to write their HTML by hand. We all used to open Notepad and get cracking. But what happened from the sort of mid-2000s onwards is that we started to see people use JavaScript frameworks, component libraries, things like React or Vue, Ember. And what we've arrived at now is a generation of developers, particularly who kind of came of age, if you like, in that time frame, who now really don't understand how to write HTML. And so they don't understand that it's vital to accessibility. So my company goes in and we'll say something like, you know, oh, you've got a heading there, but you've only made it big text. You haven't actually marked it up with the right HTML to let screen reader users know it's a heading. Use these, you know, these HTML elements to do that. And we find people just looking at us like we're, you know, grown a spare head because they simply don't know. They're just so used to getting their JavaScript to summon up a thing, but they don't understand how the nuts and bolts of the web work anymore. And I think that's probably got a huge part to play in all of this. It's why we get a lot of stuff that, you know, isn't keyboard accessible. I'm sure you come across it all the time. You'll be reading a bit of text, and something about a phrase will just make you think, that sounds like it ought to be a link. But it's not. My screen reader didn't tell me it. And, you know, if you're feeling energetic, a bit of mouse simulation or, you know,
Yeah,
keyboard funkiness might prove your point. But that's a
that's a
really good
classic
example.
example, because you're clicking or you're hitting return or whatever on where you think there should be a link, but it's not indicated by your screen reader, and quite often it will open.
And that's absolutely because what a lot of these JavaScript libraries are doing is using an element like a span that has no semantics, so it doesn't tell us it's a link or a button or any other kind of thing. We don't get to hear about it at all. They're adding JavaScript to make it mouse interactive most of the time, sometimes keyboard interactive too, but because we're missing that bit of information that says, hey, this thing is interactive, you can do something with it. Yeah, we've got a problem. So that's a really good example of what I think a big part of the problem has been.
I must admit, though, I was getting quite confident that AI assistance would come to our rescue with regards to web design and maintaining them, etc. But when you said earlier, and I hope I'm understanding you correctly, that they're tending to show the same tendencies as humans, and that
For now, yes.
what their perceptions are of our requirements. But I think there's more chance that the AI will improve quicker
Yes.
than humans will.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think you're right. And there's already a lot of work happening in that direction. So lots of people experimenting with you know, skills and instructions that you can give to these models, you know, to say, you know, I have it. I use Claude most of the time now, and you know, it has a set of instructions on how to deal with me. You know, every account has this. It's not just something I've put in place. But one of the things is, yeah, everything you do, say, produce, or otherwise generate
Do
Must
you
have
use
gone
any
to.
other assistant as well as in addition to Word, a Claude, sorry?
I use Claude for most things most of the time, because I think it is still the better option for the more technical stuff, coding particularly. I don't use ChatGPT anymore, mostly because its personality drives me potty. I don't know if anybody was it Red Dwarf? Any Red Dwarf fans out there used to have that just over cheerful toaster in it. I just find ChatGPT just, no matter how many times I tell it not to be just ridiculously cheerful, over bright, over optimistic, flattering, it just,
Oh.
yeah, I just don't get on.
So
I don't get on with it.
does it not allow you to customize it then?
It does a bit, but it, I just, I, compared to Claude, which I find a lot, yeah, just
That's
more.
more that is Claude's more customizable in your
For me,
experience.
at least, I'm
Yeah,
sure it's
yeah.
different for every kind of sort of a person. So yeah, I use Meta though through my Ray-Ban glasses, and yeah, I do use, you know, other models and other bits and pieces. There's a nice one called PT Green, Green PT, which is nice because it's sustainable. So
Oh
the
yeah.
models they use are trained on, you know, using sustainable fuel sources, and they have a sort of a good privacy focus, which is yeah, is good to
Okay. I think that's it from me, Julian.
know.
Thanks. Thanks, Ray. So yeah, so it's we're 8:45, so we're sort of approaching the end of the conversation, but there's time for a few more questions if anyone would like to raise them.
I can ask another one if you want.
Yeah, go for it, Andrew.
So positive question. So from a screen reader perspective, we talk about like there's all these new versions of JAWS coming out every year with updates and stuff. How many of those would you say, would you say like in the last sort of two, yes, 20, 25, 26 kind of thing, how many of those have actually actively improved what happens on a website in terms of if the users weren't using those later versions, they would get a worse experience? And from a positive perspective, what would you say in terms of from an accessibility perspective is something you are like really excited like over not such as AI, but for example, a new feature in JAWS, like a bookmark feature or something that's happening in HTML that might make something easier for people going forward?
Sure. So I think AI pretty much comes into it all the way through that. The features I found most useful in JAWS that have arrived in the last year or so have been the evolution to PictureSmart. So the fact that it'll now query Claude or ChatGPT and yeah, as I said earlier, get you those image descriptions, but also let you ask questions. That's been amazingly valuable. As to the feature that's coming, that's also the same. I don't know if any of you have caught the mentions of this so far, but Vispero is working on an AI agent that will ship with JAWS. So I've been playing with this recently. I don't know when it'll be released. I suspect now, probably next year sometime. But it's an entire AI agent that will exist within JAWS. So you'll call it up using a layered keystroke like you do PictureSmart or any of those other things. But you can essentially ask it to help you do stuff, interact with your desktop, fill in forms on websites, all of the things that we, you know, all of the problems that we encounter with applications and websites and other bits and pieces in theory. There'll be an agent inside JAWS that will have been trained, you know, with a very clear directive to be able to assist someone who is a screen reader user to get more stuff done. So if they manage to crack that, I suspect that'll be huge.
But would you say that somebody like using, for example, JAWS, if they're using the latest version of Edge, and I know you probably haven't tried it because you're pretty much on the latest kit, but if they're, let's say, on JAWS 2024, for example, using the latest version of Edge, their experience with the web is probably likely to be the same as something like someone using JAWS 2026, that there aren't huge like improvements overall in what JAWS does between versions.
No, not huge improvements for sure. I mean, JAWS, like the team on, NVDA, I think to a lesser extent the team working on VoiceOver, they all make steady progress, in fixing bugs, adding, new features and new issues. There's also quite a bit of work going in at the web standard side of things to add new features to HTML. It's a slow and painstaking process, but there is still work going on there, and the group that are working on that, the cross browser teams working on that, have got accessibility, pretty front and center in what they're trying to accomplish, which is encouraging too. So we're starting to see a few new features emerging in HTML that have got accessibility baked in, which is, really good news.
I'm not trying to tell people they shouldn't be upgrading their screen reader, by the way, because I've always
No,
advocated
but
to
I mean,
people to do it. But
with
now I'm
JAWS
just
especially, of
interested.
course, there's a cost impact to that
Yeah,
that not
absolutely. And
everybody
I
can
think
afford.
I'm what I'm interested in terms of what you're saying is there's not huge, there's steady progress, but there's not anything massive in terms of what people are doing that's massively changed the accessibility landscape, in terms of like just what's going on in HTML perspective and what JAWS is doing, but there's a lot of AI and other things are going to help that, but and there are steady improvements, but there's not something that's massively new kind of thing like ARIA or any or something coming on like that's changing the game for us.
No, I mean, ARIA itself, there's, new version either just out or just about to be out. But again, it's fairly incremental. So yeah, I'd say across all of the screen readers, it's slow and steady progress on that side of things rather than, big kind of revolutionary new features.
And the last thing everyone's saying the last thing I want to say is I don't know if Carl's still here, but if Leonie doesn't want to do her self-promotion, then I'm going to do it for her, and that you should probably get someone in to do that to do a audit of a website and then look at what they're doing and copy what they're doing. That's what most of the professionals do when they want to get something, when they want to look at how what people are doing and the best way forward. How many times have I copied someone else's work? When I was a consultant, I literally just took a whole load of paperwork from someone else and just copied the whole thing and just use their headings and the presentation style and everything else. So
But it's how the
that's
web was built. I mean, I taught myself HTML by poking people who'd learned it probably like a month earlier than I had, because the web really wasn't that new at the time. But absolutely, copying people was how everybody learns. Thank you for
Thank you.
that,
Leonie, I've got a it's Julian here. I've got a question.
Andrew.
Do you think that the products like Be My Eyes Workplace will increasingly have a role in reducing the friction? Well, you talked about the AI agent within JAWS, but do you think that there's going to be a significant shift in the landscape from needing to use traditional screen readers to sort of supplementary technology that where AI sort of replaces the need for it? Do you see those growing and a shift in the type of tools people are using in the workplace?
I suspect so, because if, and it is a big if, these AI agents and tools, get good at what they do, they're almost certainly going to be easier than doing it the other way. I suspect, like I was saying earlier, it in many circumstances, it's going to be a lot easier to say to an agent, "Go and do this thing for me, please," than it is to sit down, open your browser, tap, click, press, whatever. Even assuming maximum accessibility in every place for everything you wanted to do, just the physical effort of interacting with the website is likely to be more than asking a thing to go off and do it. It's the same thing why remote controls were so popular, because it was just a lot easier to pick up a remote control than it was to stand up and poke the telly, to change the channel. And humans are a bit like that. We will always take the easy, least resistant path. And so I suspect AI will certainly become more and more part of everybody's lives.
I'm really interested in promoting digital skills amongst younger visually impaired people, because we see young people coming out of college and schools not being able to be independent users of technology. And,
Right.
I speak to quite a lot of, we get a lot of inquiries from people who are 25, 28, they've done a degree, very knowledgeable, bright people, but they can't use a PC. And I'm sort of saying, right, okay, you need to learn to touch type. And, do you think that, do you still think it's good advice to be saying to young people, you need to get your basic,
Yes.
assistive tech skills and, using Microsoft packages? You just need to have that under your belt if you're going to be employable, and it's not going to go away anytime soon.
No, absolutely. I think it's still, vital to have those in the same way that, it's still good to be able to add up and read and write. Things will change about the way we do these things, but for the foreseeable future, we are still going to need to, use a keyboard, use speech input, use a mouse, whatever your input mechanisms are. They're not going away, not least because, for all everybody's jumping up and down about AI at the moment, and companies are trying to find ways to incorporate it. I suspect it's going to be an awfully long time before everybody stops using Office in the workplace, or Google Workspace, or whatever it will be. Those routine applications, those portals, those websites, those internal systems that cost millions are not going to be replaced, anytime soon, because they're expensive. So yeah, I suspect the old ways of doing things will be with us for a long time to come.
That's helpful, thank you. I shall keep plugging away and sort of championing the cause to promote sort of core digital skills with people.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you. We got a couple of minutes left. Any final what maybe one final question before we wrap up? No, if not, oh, where there is Ray, come back in. Yeah,
Yeah,
thank you.
just a, it's more a suggestion than a question, Julian. After what you said about those people in their 20s having left university with a degree and severely lacking in their ICT skills, would that be a good topic for a Tavik Zoom session?
I'm sure it would be. Yeah, I think sort of
No.
encouraging and supporting people to develop
Yeah.
those skills and how we can do that. Something
And
I'd like to do is,
just signpost them onto all kinds of other organizations and.
well, I think there's that, but I think Tavip has a has an opportunity to mentor young people, to encourage them, support them, help them troubleshoot, motivate them, and sort of mentor a journey so that they build that confidence and skill that they need to build their employability. So I think, yeah, I think Tavip's got a quite a unique the Tavip community could play an important role in offering that sort of support and encouragement to young people. So yeah, definitely that'd be something to I'd love to explore further. So thank you for that.
Mean that must have been a struggle for them, though, getting their assignments in on
Yeah, I
time.
mean, people, well, they tell me that they've had often had support to do it. So they've used their iPads a lot.
All right.
They found ways around it, and I think the danger within education seems to be that they're supported to achieve the outcomes in education, but they're not supported to the skills they're going to need for later life. And that's a real shame.
Think there's a nice idea I heard years ago. It was framed as sending the elevator back down. So people who've reached a certain point in their careers or their experience or their knowledge, send the elevator back down so you can help bring other people up to your level of experience.
Sure. I
I
love
think
that, yeah.
that's absolutely what
Yeah.
Tavip could do is formalizing what the mailing list does, and I'm sure
Yeah.
other parts already do, but just as you say, making it a bit more structured perhaps. And
Well, I
Yeah.
think Tavit certainly ticks that box in several ways, doesn't it?
I
Absolutely.
think and that's why we started these career talks, to be fair, was to reach out to younger people, encourage them to explore careers, not just using tech, but in tech as well. As a really good career opportunity and accessibility. And I know that in other countries, particularly in the States, that there are organizations for blind and partially sighted people that provide very good training on, becoming accessibility consultants and training on assistive tech. And we're just not there in this country. We don't have those career development routes and training. So I'm, it would be great to try and champion that and see how Tabit can support that. So yeah, I think watch this space.
I think
I
I'm
think
quite
there's room
sorry.
for both of these things. That where Ray started off with the idea of a Zoom session, you could imagine a panel gathered together with lots of knowledge about resources. So it could be a recorded session with a whole list of links associated with it, and in turn leading into the idea of mentoring, as you say, Julian.
Yeah, that's a good idea, Tony. Thank you. So I'll just
Sorry,
say,
Leonie was going to say something, I think.
No, thank
it was
you. Oh,
actually
okay.
me that was going to say something,
Oh,
but
sorry.
yeah, no, I feel very strongly that that there's a gap there, because I've actually come across this myself, and a few blind people have like literally finished university and then they've just not gone on to do anything else. And I think there's so many things that we can't go over now, but it's just and even I'm slightly one of the things I would say is that there is still a big issue in terms of people wanting to be spoon-fed, and I still and there has to be some like onus to move things back onto those people. We have we can help them in what they're learning, but I think I really do feel that the only way that they're going to get moved on is by actually doing it themselves. How much time did I spend, and probably other people doing breaking things and fixing things, and that's the thing. But that does seem to be a big problem, and I think that's partly because of education just gives them the answer to succeed, and that doesn't exist outside of that setting.
In your career talk, Andrew, rather as Leonie did tonight, you had some great examples of things you'd done that you could get on your CV. If I remember rightly, it was developing a web server or some websites. Which you could put in front of an employer, which, once having developed some of these skills, th these are ways people could make themselves more visible.
Exactly. So it's anything, and it's like Leon, it's like Leonie was saying, like post on a blog, post on LinkedIn, post something that will get yourself seen, that that even if it's only a short thing, because that then it moves you on. Everything you do moves you on.
And also
Yeah.
look at the things that we can do better. I proofread a lot of what my company sends out to customers and things, because I can do it far quicker with a screen reader and far more reliably. You know what
Yes.
it's like. You'll spot a spelling mistake a mile off with a screen reader
Yes,
because it
yes.
will sound weird. But also, most of us tend to listen at a rate far faster than most people can read at. So looking for the areas where actually the way we do things are more efficient, or more useful or productive. I think that's another way to look at things too.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I think that's yeah, absolutely important. And Tabit's been reaching out to some of the charities working with children, young people, to go to them if you like, and try to build support and engagement in the sector. There's lots more to do in that space, but yeah, working in partnership and being proactive in offering engaging with younger people's organisations, I think, is another important area for us. So I'm going to just draw it to a close, just because of time, and it's been a really interesting conversation. But Tony,
Yes.
do you want to draw things to a close and finish up?
Yeah, okay. So obviously, I'd like to thank Leonie for a really interesting and particularly thought-provoking talk, particularly the stuff on AI, the advantages and drawbacks, some real food for thought there. But the whole thing's been really worthwhile. Thanks for being prepared to engage with the audience and answering some fairly in-depth questions. That's been great too. So thank you very much, and looking forward to your continued involvement within Tabit.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been an immense amount of fun. So,
Good.
yep, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Leonie, and thanks everyone for coming this evening, and we'll see you again soon. Okay, good
Cheers.
night.
Cheers. Cheers, Bob.
Bye.
Good night.
Cheers.
Thanks a lot.